And he accordingly studied Hebrew, though there is no certain knowledge concerning his instructor in that language. From about this period, 212 to 213, beginning of the 3rd century, dates Origen's acquaintance with Ambrose of Alexandria, whom he was instrumental in converting from Valentinianism to Orthodoxy. Now, we'll talk about Valentinianism. Valentine's Day did not originate there. Later, about 218, Ambrose, a man of wealth, made a formal agreement with Origen to promulgate his writings and all the subsequent works of Origen, except his sermons, which were not expressly prepared for publication, were dedicated to Ambrose. I wonder if that put any strings on him, real or implied. In 213 or 214, Origen visited Arabia at the request of the prefect, who wished to have an interview with him, and Origen accordingly spent a brief time in Petra, after which he returned to Alexandria. In the following year, 215, a popular uprising at Alexandria caused Caracalla to let his soldiers plunder the city, shut the schools, and expel all foreigners. The latter measure caused Ambrose to take refuge in Caesarea, where he seems to have made his permanent home, and Origen, who felt that the turmoil hindered his activity as a teacher and imperiled his safety, left Egypt, apparently going with Ambrose to Caesarea, where he spent some time. He became friendly with rich parishioners. Took a few perks. Here, in conformity with local usage, based on Jewish custom, Origen, though not in orders, preached and interpreted the scriptures at the request of the bishops Alexander of Jerusalem and Theotistus of Caesarea. Now, with the Roman Church, made the national church, the Judaizing church that had fled Jerusalem is now replaced with the Catholic Church of Jerusalem. And the See of Jerusalem is moving to position because of its historic origins. When, however, the confusion in Alexandria subsided, Demetrius recalled Origen, probably in 216. Next 10 years, little is known, obviously devoted to teaching and writing. The latter was rendered the more easy for him by Ambrose, who provided him with more than 7 stenographers to take dictation in relays, as many scribes to prepare longhand copies, and a number of girls to multiply the copies. Remember, he's castrated, so don't worry. Don't start judging the poor guy. At least I'll give that fundamentalist credit for living what he was teaching. I wish Origen's doctrine would take over the whole fundamentalist faith. So did Paul. He said to those legalists, I wish you'd cut the whole thing off. He said that in Galatians. Remember, Jess Moody got up and said he didn't really have the courage to teach it the way it really read, get Gene Scott to do it. He said that to his congregation. At the request of Ambrose, he now began a huge commentary on the Bible, beginning with John and continuing with Genesis, Psalms 1 to 25, and Lamentations, besides brief exegeses of selected texts, forming the 10 books of his Stromatice, 2 books on the resurrection, and the work on first principles. About 230 A.D., Origen entered on the fateful journey which was to compel him to give up his work at Alexandria and embittered the next years of his life. Sent to Greece on some ecclesiastical mission, I wonder if he went first class, he paid a visit to Caesarea, where he was heartily welcomed and was ordained presbyter, that no further cause for criticism might be given Demetrius, who had strongly disapproved his preaching before ordination while at Caesarea. But Demetrius, taking this well-meant act as an infringement of his rights, the Bishop of Alexandria, was furious, for not only was Origen under his jurisdiction, but if Eastern sources may be believed, Demetrius had been the first to introduce episcopal ordination in Egypt. The Metropolitan accordingly convened a synod of bishops and presbyters which banished Origen from Alexandria. Power plays. Don't change much. Churches survive this. While a second synod declared his ordination invalid. Origen accordingly fled from Alexandria. You know, I heard Jerry the Fat say, Jimmy can't preach because he's going to lose his license. Since when does a license make a preacher a preacher? Only a fathead would say that. Origen accordingly fled from Alexandria in 231, made his permanent home in Caesarea. A series of attacks on him seems to have emanated from Alexandria. Whether for his self-castration, a capital crime in Roman law, or for alleged heterodoxy is unknown. But at all events, these fulminations were heeded only at Rome. While Palestine, Phoenicia, Arabia, and Achaia paid no attention to him. At Alexandria, Heraclius became head of Origen's school, and shortly afterward, on the death of Demetrius, was consecrated bishop. At Caesarea, Origen was joyfully received and was all too cold, and was also the guest of Firmilian, bishop of Caesarea in Cappadocia, and of the empress dowager Julia Mamaea at Antioch. Empress Dowager. The former also visited him at Caesarea. You counting me down? I ain't done. Hello, whoever you are. I'm talking about Origen. The former also visited him at Caesarea, where Origen, deeply loved by his pupils, preached and taught dialectics, physics, ethics, and metaphysics, thus laying his foundation for the crowning theme of theology. He accordingly sought to set forth all the science of the time from the Christian point of view and to elevate Christianity to a theory of the universe compatible with Hellenism, Greek philosophy. In 235, with the accession of Maximinus, a persecution raged, and for 2 years Origen is said, though on somewhat doubtful authority, to have remained concealed in the house of a certain Juliana in Caesarea of Cappadocia. Little is known of the last 20 years of Origen's life. He preached regularly on Wednesdays and Fridays, and later daily. He evidently, however, developed an extraordinary literary productivity, broken by occasional journeys, one of which to Athens during some unknown year was of sufficient length to allow him time for research. He was a traveler. After his return from Athens, he succeeded in converting Berylus, bishop of Bostra, from his adoptionistic views. Now we've got another one to deal with. To the Orthodox faith. Yet in these very years, about 240 A.D., probably occurred the attacks on Origen's own orthodoxy, which compelled him to defend himself in writing to the Roman Pontiff Fabian and to many other bishops. Neither the source nor the object of these attacks is known, though they later may have been connected with Novationism. Now we got another one. After his conversion of Berylus, however, his aid was frequently invoked against heresies. Thus, when the doctrine was promulgated in Arabia that the soul died and decayed with the body, being restored to life only at the resurrection, appeal was made to Origen, who journeyed to Arabia and by his preaching reclaimed the erring. In 250, persecutions of the church broke out anew, and this time Origen did not escape. He was tortured, pilloried, and bound hand and foot to the block for days without yielding. These tortures seem to have resulted in his death. According to Epiphanius, Origen wrote about 6,000 works. A list was given by Eusebius in his Lost Life of Pamphilus. These works fall into four classes. By four of the most important works, to skip over the four, is on textual criticism, and it was the Hexapla. Now, to show you the amount of research this guy did, come over here. This is a sample page from his Hexapla, where he would take the Hebrew, having studied it, right here, transliterate the Hebrew into Greek, then taking other sources, compare them, like the 26 translations of the Bible would be a sample of his Hexapla style, and then show the variants. That's the 26 translations technique that you have seen. His research, like that of Eusebius, 6,000 works, supported by Ambrose as long as he dedicated. Now that's Origen. A lot more to be said about him. Particularly, I'll come back to Origen when we discuss in this period of time, the 3rd century, the works that he thought should be read in the church and accepted as authoritative. One of them was the Book of Enoch. He thought the Book of Enoch, the Apocryphal Book of Enoch, should be right in there with the rest of them. Now that's Origen. Back to Papias. Oh, you're not interested.
Yes, sir.
Well, I'm not convinced. Now we got Origen, a little synopsis. Are you starting to get convinced that some real strong personalities had some axes to grind? They weren't psychologically dishonest, but once they convinced themselves of a position, I'm sure Eusebius crossed the bridge as a historian. The crowning achievement of the church, as he studied church history that had come, look, he wrote the history of the martyrs. That was one of his books. And to see in his lifetime and play a part in it, the church literally come to dominate the Roman Empire and receive its sanction. You think he's going to do anything to weaken that position and the continued growth of the power of the church in the age of the church that he thought all church history was preparation for? You think Jerry Falwell, who saw his master plan completely go off key when he shot himself in the foot on the South African issue and gets into a Donnybrook on Nightline where Jesse Jackson reminds him of his previous racism as a preacher in the South, and he spits back at Jackson about Jackson spitting on salads served to the honkies when he was a waiter? I mean, never had his fortunes sunk so low from his grand plan. You think he came to Palm Springs and to Charlotte to save PTL and help redeem a fallen brother? Or did he have another agenda? I remember him boasting personally to me how that after he started the Moral Majority, he could pick the particular news programs he wanted to be on. Well, he kind of lost that. He became a buffoon in the South Africa situation and the fall down of the Moral Majority. He's got a vehicle to get it back. You think the news media are caring about the poor people that gave to PTL? The news media wants an agenda of their own. And the poor people out here have to sort the truth from these personal agendas. And I believe they'll do it. They've been doing it for centuries. Ain't nothing new. Okay, let's go back to Papias. Or Papias. As indicated, Papias from 50 to 150 A.D., by one interpretation, Eusebius would place him later. Now we know a little more about Eusebius as the historian, and he has an agenda. Now, the first generation of the church were expecting the imminent return of the Lord. They expected him to come in that generation. Apocalyptic literature was the most popular. But as the church moved to the stage of being the state religion in Eusebius' day, why should the Lord come? He was ruling on earth. Apocalyptic literature would only mess up the good arrangement. Plus the fact apocalyptic literature talks about a false prophet who gets people to bow down to an earthly government, which is Antichrist. So you can see the frame of reference by the time we move into Eusebius' day. The court historian, so to speak, the court theologian, in fact, ain't going to be too high on apocalyptic literature. Now, all we have of Papias' five books, the exposition of the words of Jesus, are extracts. They were around until the 12th century. They were around in Eusebius' day. But all we have now are extracts, a part of the writings of Irenaeus and Eusebius. One is the preface, or a part of the preface, which we've looked at, that raises the issue of dating for Papias. And his references to John, if they're the same John, give Papias the authority of having been taught by John the Apostle himself. And Papias also, in his works, according to Eusebius, took the revelation of John literal. Well, can you imagine the passages in John's revelation about the five mountains, or the seven mountains, and the eighth kingdom to come? A literalist seeing the harlot woman, church riding on the beast. Be the court theologian, the court historian, walk in with that and talk to the Roman emperor about it. It therefore was very much in Eusebius' interest, because of the respect that Papias had. He couldn't attack Papias direct, so he had to make Papias the student of a second John. Therefore, he could gracefully give credence to Papias' literal interpretation of the book of Revelation, but in making it the product of a second John, Presbyter John, at a later date, he diminishes the value of the revelation because it wasn't written by an apostle. He then can criticize Papias' literal interpretation of it, because if an apostle wrote it, you're criticizing the apostle. But if later John the Presbyter wrote it, you can get away with weakening the interpretation and the importance of the book of Revelation. So it is Eusebius and a Romanized church that has become the state religion that finds the book of Revelation troublesome, that made the first known effort to determine the Presbyter John to be not the apostle but another. Later opponents, including me, alleged that Eusebius had need to create the Presbyter John, a later one, in order to ascribe to him the authorship of the Apocalypse, because his repugnancy to the literalness with which Papias interpreted it made Eusebius unwilling to admit the Apostle John as the author who instructed Papias. The inconsistency is that Eusebius ardently defends the authenticity of the fourth gospel written by John. He just doesn't believe that Apostle John wrote the book of Revelation. Now, the other fragment from which he gets all these views of Papias are not so uncertain. They're explanations of the words of the Lord under the term logia. Papias did not only include the sayings of Christ, but with reference to the Gospels of Matthew and Mark, the Acts are included as well. Besides Matthew and Mark, he knew also the Gospel to the Hebrews, a fifth Gospel. And he made use of 1 John and 1 Peter. It will remain uncertain whether he knew Luke, or what is more probable, whether he knew and employed all five Gospels as the basis of his work, supplemented from other sources. His purpose was not so much to complement from oral sources the words of the Lord as laid down in the Gospels as to obtain material for the elucidation of the words of Jesus. First source was his own memory of what he had heard from the apostles, Aristion, and other first disciples of the apostles. He inquired of the pupils of the first disciples wherever he met them what of the words of Jesus these had reported, and from a time when disciple and pupil dwelt in personal association, and also of pupils of Aristion and John while they were yet alive. From the present tense that he used many times in the Greek, it is deducible that Papias commenced to gather his material before the end of the first century. We're in the dark period. The necessity for making inquiry presented itself whenever pupils of John and Aristion chanced to come to Hierapolis. The recurrence of the name of John in the fragment is met with the explanation that reports from the Jerusalem period of John's life. Oh, he goes into a Greek distinction in Eusebius' arguments on the use of the Greek tense, saying that the ones that are reports from Jerusalem, period of John's life, are of a different tense than the Ephesian period. And Eusebius endeavors to make this tenuous argument based upon tenses of the verb refer to followers of the apostle, and thus remove the John in the preface from the Apostle John to a later, now created, Presbyter John. Papias is the one who makes the statement that Matthew wrote down the sayings of Jesus while he was with him, not in Greek, but Aramaic. And it is that statement of Papias that makes some postulate that the so-called hypothetical Q document, which is a common source quoted by Matthew, Mark, and Luke, though Matthew and Luke can be found in the original to change their style, and they're directly quoting Mark. Matthew, Mark, and Luke can be found in the original style quoting another common source that all three used, which has been postulated as the hypothetical Q document. One of the candidates for that so-called Q document is what Papias says was a writing down by Matthew as he traveled with Jesus of the sayings of Jesus, not in Greek, which is the language of his gospel, written at Antioch, I believe, but in Aramaic. Oh, I'm boring you. It's too late. Yeah, I am. Let's just lay Papias down here alongside poor old mutilated Origen. You want me to continue? Now, I think with his background, I want to say a little bit about Mark and John and Luke before we get back to Antioch. And then I'm going to pick up a copy I have of Eusebius' history itself and read what he has to say now that you are prepared to expect a little bit of coloration. Okay? You all look like you've come close to Origen's dedication tonight. You look considerably pained. We've been going at it quite a while, haven't we?